We've been in the evenings working through the book of Romans, and we're in chapter 11. I'm going to read to you chapter 11, starting at verse 11 through to verse 24. So I ask, did they stumble in order that they might fall? By no means. Rather, through their trespass, salvation has come to the Gentiles, so as to make Israel jealous. Now, if their trespass means riches for the world, and if their failure means riches for the Gentiles, how much more would their full inclusion mean? Now, I'm speaking to you Gentiles, inasmuch then as I am the apostle to the Gentiles. I magnify my ministry in order somehow to make my fellow Jews jealous and thus save some of them. For if their rejection means the reconciliation of the world, what will their acceptance mean but life from the dead? If the dough offered as first fruits is holy, so is the whole lump. And if the root is holy, so are the branches. But if some of the branches were broken off, and you, of the wild olive shoot, were grafted in among the others, and now share in the nourishing root of the olive tree, do not be arrogant towards the branches. If you are, remember, it is not you who support the roots, but the root that supports you. Then you will say, branches were broken off so that I might be grafted in. That is true. They were broken off because of their unbelief, but you stand fast through faith. So do not become proud, but fear. For if God did not spare the natural branches, neither will he spare you. Note then the kindness and severity of God. Severity towards those who have fallen, but God's kindness to you, provided you continue in his kindness. Otherwise, you too will be cut off. And even they, if they do not continue in their unbelief, will be grafted in. For God has the power to graft them in again. For if you are cut from what is by nature a wild olive tree and grafted contrary to nature into a cultivated olive tree, how much more will these natural branches be grafted back into their own olive tree? Well, there's two dangers, well, a number of dangers, but two particular dangers I want us to think about in the Christian life, complacency and despair. Of course, they're equals and opposites to each other. I notice I pastorally see them in different people, sometimes in the same person. And how often I've noticed when I've been preaching, how often they come up in the Bible. And here they are again. And often what we do is we go to the Old Testament and we there's various lessons to Israel that we can then draw to ourselves. We've been thinking about that in midweek in Haggai, how we legitimately move from the Old Testament to us to draw lessons from Israel to ourselves. Here, that's true, but it's not only so, but our origins, our present, and our future are tied to Israel. There is one people of God, and they're made up of Jew and Gentile. And the question is how do they relate? And we've been thinking about this for a little while now, as we've been going through Romans. And of course, Romans is a part of it's one book, it's tied together themes, but really 9 to 11 is a kind of a discrete section. It ties in with what's before and after, but we've noticed there's a theme that holds it together, which is about Israel and their place in God's plan. And why is it that most of them are not Christian? And that raises a few questions, including our own place and how we might trust in God's word. In fact, our place and mission to the Gentiles is all tied in together. So it affects mission to the Jews. Our mission to the fact we're included, our mission to other Gentiles, like people like us, people not Jews, impacts mission to Jews. Often a Christian might muse, I'm called to overseas work, or should I stay? And that's for some people a worthy question to explore and to test the churches, to test those calls that people might feel. But actually, both are a good answer, because either choice impacts the other. So you staying even somewhere like Chelmsford, impacts the global mission in a few ways. And you going impacts us that stay here at home, even in Chelmsford. And that's especially true when we're thinking about mission locally, and mission to the world impacts the Jews. Now, this section about mission to the Jews and everyone else is related. So the whole section we've been looking at, we're thinking about the place of Israel, and there's a huge disagreement between Christians. If you want to start a fight between a group of Christians, particularly a group of evangelicals, just bring up something to do with this. And in part, that's because it relates to our views about Christ's return and the end. And that is a heated debate in and of itself. So we need to remind ourselves of that bit at the end of chapter 11. We've read it a few times already and we haven't even got there. Verses 33 to 36, that we're touching on deep mysteries here. If Paul can say, oh, the depths and the mysteries and how God's thoughts are beyond ours, if he can say that, then we need to be humble before these as well. These are mysteries in places. We're going to actually touch on the controversy next week, but that's where the really controversial bit is, but we're going to touch on it a bit now. This week, though, gives us an opportunity to just look at the text without reading back other things that we might think into it. And actually, if we concentrate on what we can say, because it's there in front of us in black and white, then when we get to the bits that Christians disagree on, we might have a bit more clarity. So we noticed last week there were two questions in chapter 11, verse 1 and verse 11. So verse 1, I asked then, has God rejected his people? And 11, I asked then, did they stumble in order that they might fall? And both times he says, by no means, absolutely no. And last week we saw it's not true that there are no Jews, that God had rejected all the Jews. That's not true. There are Jewish Christians. There's quite a lot of Jewish Christians. They're a minority, but they're a big minority. This week, it's not true that Israel has fallen to the point of no return. So the first thing we're going to think about is the Gentile mission, how Gentile mission impacts the Jews in verses 11 to 16. So mission that isn't to Jews still impacts the Jews. And it shows this, I don't know if you're thinking already, but this is not a piece of geeky theological nicety, because I can guarantee one thing, everyone here in the Zoom room, everyone who's watching on whatever platform they're watching on, every single one of you listening is a Jew or a Gentile, because everyone is a Jew or a Gentile. So it's relevant to you. And the church and its mission relates to both. And a first glance at these verses, some of Paul's argument is bizarre, but not when you unpack it. So notice the first thing that seems bizarre until you unpack it is this chain in verses 11 to 12. There's a chain of events. It goes, the gospel goes to Jews. The Jews reject Christ. The gospel then goes to Gentiles, and the Jews become jealous. That seems like a strange argument to make, but actually it's just what we observe in the book of Acts. The apostles go to the Jews first. They go to the synagogue, or they go to the river, where often there's a group of Jewish women might have met to pray. And they go there first. And many, not all, but many reject the message. The next step would be to go to the Gentiles, and they get mixed responses, but often there's a lot of positive responses. Jews then respond badly to that. So it's not just they've rejected, but you go and believe what you want. They responded very badly to that and tried to undo the work of the apostles. But we, as we see, the Gentiles, they would be watching the Gentiles and responding to the gospel and enjoying the covenant benefits, and it makes them jealous. And the hope is, Paul says, is that jealousy brings some back. Notice he says full inclusion. Now, we'll come back to what we mean by that a bit later and more next week. So what Paul does, and he does it again in verse 15, he says, how much more? If this, then how much more if they responded? So it's a how much more argument. If X is true, how much more would Y be true? I'll give you an illustration of the sort of how much more argument. And actually in the Zoom room with us, I'll embarrass her, is my sister, Zoe. So when she did her GCSEs, she got very good grades, much better grades than I got. She got very good grades, but she only revised for one exam. And I remember coming back from, I can't remember which exam it was, but she came back from the one exam she revised for and goes, that's so easy. So easy when you revise. And we went, yeah, do you think? It's not cheating. Revising is not cheating. So the exam results came back and she did very well. And it's the how much more? So you did well in exams. How much more should you revise for all of them? You know, you might have said to someone they enjoyed a visit to London. How much more if it wasn't raining when you went? That's a how much more argument. And so here, Paul's saying, if the Jews rejecting Christ leads to blessing to the Gentiles, how much greater a blessing if they'd received him? If they're rejecting him is to our benefit, then them receiving would actually be an even bigger benefit. It would be like death to life. We saw some of this in Ephesians years ago when we looked at that. God demonstrates his power through the unity of the church, especially the Jew-Gentile unity, which makes all other ethnic divisions trivial. Now, verse 13, Paul mentions he is the apostle to the Gentiles. And he's almost like his conscience is talking about the Jews for three chapters. And it's quite solid stuff in places. And it's featured in earlier chapters in Romans as well. But how he shows how his mission to the Gentiles is linked to that of the Jews in verses 13 to 14. So he says, I'm speaking to you Gentiles inasmuch then as I am an apostle to the Gentiles, I magnify my ministry in order that somehow to make my fellow Jews jealous and thus save some of them. So his hope is that his ministry to the Gentiles brings about jealousy and brings some Jews in. But notice he says a few. He knows it will be only a few. Now, how does this jealousy work? Again, that sounds like an odd argument. Jealousy is not something we usually think of as a good thing. But that's not always the case. There is a godly jealousy, and God himself, in certain contexts, we're told, is jealous. Jealousy is often caused by insecurity. And it raises questions because of our insecurity, often a result of greed or lust or coveting, breaking the 10th commandment. So for example, a bad example would be, I have a car and I should be content with that car. It's God's provision to me. But I might be jealous of your newer car or your older but nicer car, and I could be jealous. But that'd be wrong. Worse, I could covet my neighbour's wife. That's not being content with your own wife, if you have one, or husband, and a desire to have someone or something that someone else is in a wrong way. That would be a bad thing. But there's a right kind of jealousy and even a right kind of coveting. And that is wanting what is rightfully yours in a good and godly way. For example, if someone steals your car, that's not coveting to want it back. Your wife gives attention or your husband gives attention that's rightfully for yours to another. There's within the right levels of proportion, a right kind of jealousy. God is jealous of idolatrous worship to pretend gods. That is attention that should be his. In Daniel 9, looked at a couple of weeks ago, midweek, at the end of the prayer, the archangel comes to Daniel and says, God has heard your prayer. And he, the English version should say things like, he's heard you, he has your attention. And actually the word is he covets you. He loves you and he desires for you. So Israel here becoming jealous is not actually a bad thing. Some expressions of jealousy are, we've just thought of, but some are a right kind of jealousy, a good kind of jealousy. Now, of course, some of what they were doing, some of their expressions of jealousy worked out very badly. For example, persecution and hatred. But when they see Gentiles relate to God in a covenant community with each other, and some Jews starting to be included in that, and racial boundaries being lowered and broken, so that people who might have normally been at odds with each other are now included with each other. And they think, I want that. I want to be part of that too. And then that's a good thing. When they see those old covenant promises of how it starts with Israel and then goes out and includes people in distant islands, and we'd be counted in that category from Old Testament terms, wouldn't we? And they want to be part of that. The idea of seeing what they're missing, that it is rightfully theirs, but they've thrown it away. But they can have it back. So jealousy here is a positive motive. And it's not using, it's not a case of using any means to achieve an end. Some people do that. If we could trick people into church, bolt the doors, haha, now we're going to tell you about Jesus. No, it's not that sort of thing. Paul acknowledges even that some of his efforts result in only a few. But verse 16, he goes on and says, but if the dough offered as first fruits is holy, so is the whole lump. And if the root is holy, so are the branches. This is an idea from the Old Testament, that the bread offered to represent the whole of Israel, a small offering represents the whole. So this small offering shows that the whole can be included. They just need to come to faith. And so these few saved as a result of Paul's ministry during Paul's lifetime is a down payment or a sign of a greater harvest that was to come sometime down the road. And that links to what we said in verse 12 about their full inclusion. Now, he doesn't mean every Jew will be saved. That would run against the flow of everything in Romans thus far and what's to come. But there is, Paul's talking about a future harvest among the Jews that would suggest an amount, that God has an amount in mind when they come in the future. And we'll come back to this next week, what we mean by that. So this is a process, this chain of the Jews reject, it goes to the Gentiles, they become jealous, and then they're included. And God's used this Jewish rejection to bring in Gentiles, and he uses Gentile acceptance to bring in the Jews. Jews reject, bring in us, our acceptance brings in the Jews. That all sounds very interesting, and Christians can have a great big argument about this, believe it or not. Is it relevant? Well, are you a Gentile Christian? Then yes, it's relevant. If you're a Jewish Christian, it's also relevant. Because we should, as Gentiles, have a concern for the Jews. God has not finished with them or given up on them. So pray for their conversion. Pray for a softening of them and for mission to them. And there are various missions to the Jews, but all mission to all kinds of people has an impact on moving Jews closer to Christ. And this moves us to Paul's illustration, where he'll also give us more reasons about why we should be concerned for the Jews. And so we have an illustration about God's kindness and severity in verses 11 to 24. It's this illustration of an olive tree. And beginning of verse 22, he says, note then the kindness and severity of God. I'm thinking about the kindness and severity of God. And that is a kindness and severity he shows to Jews and Gentiles. Now, historically, God dealt with the Jews first, and then he started to deal, he's always dealt with Gentiles, but he dealt with the Jews first, then the Gentiles. Of course, he's still dealing with Jews. He always dealt with Gentiles. Also notice it's a pastoral issue, verse 18. Do not be arrogant towards the branches. If you are, remember that it is not you who support the root, but the root that supports you. So it might be the majority of the Gentile church in Rome was looking down on the Jews, either as a group, just don't bother with them, or as Jewish Christians, they're somehow less significant, that the heritage that Christianity comes from is somehow irrelevant. Anti-Semitism has always been an issue everywhere, every time. Obviously, racism is an issue everywhere, every time, because people are not always very good with differences. But the Jews, because they're meant to keep themselves distinct, they might be in a society, but distinct from the society by their food and their clothing and their morality, they were marked out as different. They're marked out as arrogant for doing it. And that leads to anti-Semitism. And of course, we know the kind of lengths that are possible with that. But that might that attitude come into the church at times? Well, sadly, we know that it has. Even some of the great names have been accused of anti-Semitism. Might we be tempted to think, well, they gave up, tough, or worse? That sometimes through history, the Jews have been labelled as those who crucified Christ. Well, actually, Gospels make it pretty clear they were. And the Romans, i.e. Gentiles like us, were all complicit. Might we be discouraged if, as some of us have, if you've ever shared the gospel with someone who's Jewish and practicing Jewish, and you get a pretty rough tongue back. I've got to say that it's not, you don't get the, I'm just not interested. You get a fairly full on treatment back. I found maybe we're discouraged, or maybe we think, why do I get that? And you have a anti-Jewish sentiment, perhaps. It's because of this distinctiveness and this identity, Jews are particularly sensitive to talk about Jesus as Christ. It undermines everything that they hold dearly and their own personal identity and value, and because of things that have happened to them in history, they're very, very sensitive. It's understandable. Paul then wants us to understand our status and basis. All through Romans, it is by faith, by faith, by faith, in Christ, by grace, accessible by faith. But we are we're included by this covenant. We are still this covenant, one covenant people of God. So we're included by faith. Jews, if they don't believe, have excluded themselves, but there's still this one covenant that goes right the way back to Abraham. So how are we Gentiles included? Well, the illustration here is that the people of God is like an olive tree. So Israel is like the root and the trunk, and it's a cultivated olive tree. And branches come off the cultivated trees. Cultivated branches come off. And those are the branches that are faithless. They're taken off. That is unbelieving Israel. Those unbelieving Jews are cut away from the root. At the same time, wild branches, that's us Gentiles, are grafted in. But the root and the trunk is still Israel. So you have one covenant people, Israel, root branches, root trunk branches, but some are cut off and the new ones are put in that aren't native to it, they're new to it. So in one sense, we are equals. We have equal access to God and so on. But in another sense, we're not equals in that of time, in that it is their tree and we're included into it as equals. And that some of them have been removed that makes room for us. We're grafted on, and that means, Paul says, there's no place for arrogance. Now, this illustration has been questioned. If you know anything about grafting, and I know virtually nothing other than I have some roses and a cherry tree, in both cases, the root and the very bottom of it is wild, and you cultivate, the cultivated bit goes on. Because cultivated plants are a bit more wussy, so you have the wild roots, and then you cultivate the rose or the cherry or whatever it is onto the wild bit. And so some people have concluded then that Paul is a clueless townie, like me, who doesn't know anything about agriculture. If only Haddon or someone had been around a bit earlier, he could have explained it all to him. And some people just say it just doesn't work then as a result. But we have now found an ancient practice, and it is still used in some parts of the world today, where if you have a very old cultivated olive tree, old cultivated branches are removed and new wild branches are added to stimulate growth. Well, that's what God's been doing, isn't it? So as the tree ages, any tree that as it ages, it needs pruning in order to become, to maximize its fruitfulness. So I've got some fruit bushes and trees back in front garden, and I need to prune them to maximize the fruit. At a certain age, though, it heads into inevitable decline, and it needs, and in the case of olive trees, when they're ancient trees, they need this stimulus. That's what Paul's talking about. So as you step back then and you see God's plan, Israel fruits, stagnates, and then the Gentiles come in and it bears fruit again from the Gentiles that have been grafted in to this ancient plan of salvation. So what is the difference between the branches that have been removed and the branches that have been grafted in and the branches that have been kept in? Well, the difference is verse 20. They were broken off because of their unbelief, but you stand fast through faith. So do not become proud, but fear. Faith is the difference. And so he goes on in verse 21 and 22. For if God did not spare the natural branches, neither will he spare you.
Note then the kindness and severity of God, severity towards those who have fallen, but God's kindness to you, provided you continue in this kindness, otherwise you too will be cut off. So it demonstrates God's kindness and patience, but also his severity with those who finally continue in unbelief. God does not spare unbelieving Israel. Do you think he'll spare unbelieving Gentiles? Do you think he'll treat you better? If the cultivated branches need the chop, unfruitful wild ones don't get special treatment either. We're only in this position by faith, both cultivated and wild, Jew and Gentile. Those removed are those with no faith, who persisted without faith. But not the end. That's not the end of it. Verses 23 to 24. Even they, if they do not continue in their unbelief, will be grafted in, for God has the power to graft them in. For if you were cut off from what is by nature a wild olive tree and grafted, contrary to nature, into a cultivated olive tree, how much more will these, the natural branches, be grafted back into their own olive tree? How much more will the naturally cultivated be regrafted? If we can be grafted in, how much more naturally will a Jewish person be grafted in? Yes, most of Israel rejected the gospel, but Paul has stated way earlier in Romans that theirs are the patriarchs, the Old Testament, the law, the covenant. How easy for them to accept Christ and be regrafted into his people. God is still patiently holding out the offer to them. Again, this is very interesting about Israel, but what about the rest of us? Well, a big theme in these chapters we've seen already is humility. Our position as Gentiles is that we are grafted in, we are adopted. We have all the privilege to enjoy the covenant of grace. There is one covenant people of God, but our roots into it have been very different. Jews were chosen by grace to be in God's people. We, by grace, have been included in with them, but later. And so humility to continue in faith. There's no place for complacency. We don't deserve our place. Jew or Gentile doesn't deserve it. We must continue to confess our need and helplessness and cling to Christ by faith. Humility, continue in faith. But that also means there's no place for despair, because it's God who holds us in. Do you notice the scale of God's plan, specifically about Israel? Really, you can't detach his plan for Israel and the world. It's the same plan. But this plan for them, to us, and our inclusion towards them, it starts, you know, to stand before God as equal. If it includes Jew and Gentile, and all the Gentile subdivisions become trivial, making racism nonsensical in the church, and therefore undermines a major achievement of the gospel. The plan is God's plan over millennia to bring a specific people together, his church, made up of all kinds of people, even down to the order that they'd come in. Even the plan that these people reject then, and these people accept, and their acceptance will bring in those, and their rejection will bring in them. So many things in the church and outside of the church leads us to despair or complacency, just keep things ticking along. Perhaps as we look at the response of certain people groups, we feel discouraged, especially the Jews, it must be said. We see successes or the fact we remain faithful, and it could lead us to arrogance, which leads us to complacency. Perhaps, well, I'm in, leads us to complacency. But in Romans 11, it shows there's no place to be complacent. And there's no place for despair.